My guest today, Charles Glass, had an extensive career as a broadcaster, journalist, and writer, which I'll attempt to encapsulate. He began his journalistic career in 1973 at ABC News Beirut Bureau with Peter Jennings, covering the October Arab-Israeli War that year on the Egyptian and Syrian fronts. He also covered the civil war in Lebanon, where he was wounded by artillery fire in 1976. Charles served as ABC News Chief Middle East Correspondent from 1983 to 1993, and since then he's been a freelance writer in Paris, Tuscany, Venice, and London, regularly covering the Middle East, the Balkans, Southeast Asia, and the Mediterranean region for publications in Europe and the United States. In 1987, he was abducted and held hostage in Lebanon for 2 months before escaping from his Shia captors. The next year, he exposed Saddam Hussein's then-secret biological weapons program, which seems to have come back to harm U.S. troops in Iraq, which I reported earlier. U.S. government officially rejected his claim until Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. Charles Glass has written more than a half dozen books while covering wars in the Middle East, Eritrea, Rhodesia, Somalia, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina, including the 2000 invasion of Iraq for ABC News and Harper's Magazine. He returned to Iraq in 2004 for the Independent of London and the London Review of Books. Most recently, he has written an article for the New York Review of Books entitled "In the Syria We Don't Know," which is one of the things I'm going to speak with him about today. Welcome once again, Charles Glass, to Takes on the World.
Thank you.
Good to have you back here. Before we get to your latest article on Syria, I'd like to get your sense of how last week's Republican victory in our national elections is being seen in Italy, if indeed much attention is paid to it.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm writing a book at the moment. I've been holed away in the countryside in Italy working on my book, and I haven't paid much attention to Italian politics. I imagine, like the rest of Europe, the right wing likes it, and the left wing doesn't like it. That's just my assumption, but I don't know much more than that. I'm sorry about that.
Well, that's quite all right. I also would like to get into it later, what you think the impact might be on U.S. policy towards Syria. Two years ago, this past August, I interviewed you about the situation in Syria, and obviously the situation has changed a great deal in those 2 years. Perhaps you could describe how you see it now and how you describe it in your current article.
Well, in 2011, when the rebellion against Bashar al-Assad's regime began, it was a limited affair with a large numbers of people in Syria demanding reform and many demanding a change of government. Since then, the war has escalated so that those reformers who were in the opposition at the beginning have been sidelined, and those who proposed a violent course have taken the ascendancy and, of course, have invited foreign help in two forms. First, governments, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United States, Britain, France, and others, to give them money and weapons, and then calling on those jihadists, militant Islamists who are sympathetic to an Islamic takeover of Syria, to come and fight with them for what has now become fundamentally a jihadist cause.
This, as you pointed out and others pointed out, it seems that those jihadists, which were backed from the beginning from the Saudis and Qatar, are now supposedly allies of the United States in suppressing Islamic State, or Daesh, as they're calling it there. This seems to be almost an unprecedented situation in which you have, if it is indeed blowback and not intended, throws the people of Syria, those remaining, into a quandary, because obviously those who wanted to change the government and make more democratic government than Bashar al-Assad offered, realizes that the alternative seemed to be far, far worse. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, if they were seeking, and I believe they were, democracy, then the Nusra Front and Daesh, or the Islamic State and others, are explicitly anti-democratic. They want to establish a non-elected theocracy. So the people who wanted reforms and democracy and freedom of speech and the other things that they've been denied under the Ba'athist regime in Damascus, those people now have nowhere to go. They're neither side appeals to them. Many of them now find themselves hoping that the regime will win, because at least the regime will allow them some measure of freedom, and particularly of social freedom, whereas the Islamists do not. For the United States, it was a tricky strategy from the beginning, because on the one hand, they supported these people in Syria, but didn't want them to do what they were doing in Syria in Iraq. But of course, the war spread to Iraq, and it spread to a lesser extent to Lebanon. And this was not an outcome that the United States, possibly Turkey, were seeking, but it was an inevitable outcome as those groups grew stronger and developed their own sources of finance and seized weapons from the Iraqi army, so that they didn't really need their foreign backers so much anymore. They still need Turkey, though, to have access to the border to get supplies across, but otherwise they've become virtually independent. I spoke to one Arab diplomat in Damascus who said it's like a lion tamer who can feed the lion and train the lion, but someday the lion may turn around and bite him.
One of the things that has amazed many people outside of the region and has drawn all kinds of conspiracy theories is the incredible sophistication in dealing with the media, the global media, that Daesh, the Islamic State, has demonstrated, as well as their skill in using weapons that U.S. taxpayers had provided to the army of Iraq. This obviously wasn't an overnight operation. Perhaps you could kind of tell us how that developed, or how you see it developed.
Well, they're clearly intelligent. They have a strategy. They have objectives. They know how to use their weapons. Many of them were trained in other countries. Many of them served in other armies, so they know what they're doing. There's no doubt that they're a formidable force who have eaten alive many of the tribes in Iraq and have killed many people in Syria, and most of the places they've gone to, they've taken. So they are a serious force to be reckoned with. The Syrian army has managed to keep them out of certain areas, particularly most of western Syria. But the Iraqi army had much less success in Sinjar and the borders of Iraqi Kurdistan, and almost to the gates of Baghdad itself. It's going to be interesting to see, and very obviously painful to see, how this is going to play out.
There are reports, many reports, that many former officers with Saddam Hussein's army are now part of Daesh, and this raises the question, that was a secular government under Saddam Hussein, and assuming that the Sunnis in Iraq at the time were fairly secular as well, it would seem that Daesh's positions, Islamic State's positions, are totally contradictory to what the positions were of Saddam in terms of religion.
No, but many Sunnis, even if they're not practicing, still feel that they are Sunnis. They identify with their clans and their people, and they felt very hard pressed by the government in Baghdad, so that when Daesh, which originated in Iraq and subsequently went to Syria, when it grew in strength in Syria and came back into Iraq, many Sunnis in Iraq welcomed them because they were fed up with the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad, and they saw them as liberators. I don't know, from what I've read, I haven't been to those Islamic State-controlled areas in Iraq, but from what I've read, many people now living under them, including former Ba'athists, do not like the way that they're being governed, even though they're being governed by Sunnis, partly because they're being governed by foreigners and Chechens and Afghans and Pakistanis and Arabs from outside Iraq, and partly because they do not want their women to be covered. They do not want to abide by Sharia law. They don't want to be pushed around in the street by young gunmen, and they're having a difficult time. And the Ba'athist officers, senior officers who cooperated with them, cooperated mainly to drive out what they saw as an occupying force, which was the almost entirely Shiite army of Iraq, which was they saw as hostile to them.
going back to the origins of the Iraq War and the disbandment of the Iraq Army, which somehow people believe was simply a decision by one man named Paul Bremer, not made in Washington. I've never been able to quite understand how people could believe that one man without military experience would go to Iraq and suddenly make those decisions. But that it almost seemed inevitable. I mean, President George Bush Sr., one of the reasons he had said he did not take Saddam out at the time in 1991 was because he did not want to destabilize the region and end up with an endless occupation. And of course, he actually was very prophetic in those words, with those words. But was this an inevitable turn, a turn of events in your eyes?
Well, in 1991, the United States had one objective, which was to take Kuwait back from the Iraqi army, to drive the Iraqi army out of Kuwait and reestablish the pseudo-independence of Kuwait. Beyond that, they didn't have as an objective overthrowing a regime with which it had been in sympathy for the previous 10 years in the Iran-Iraq war. But it you have to remember that they also, the United States, when George Bush gave a speech calling on the Iraqi people to rise up and overthrow the dictator, they did rise up. The Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south rose up. They took 14 out of 18 provinces of Iraq, and they nearly overthrew Saddam. It was only when the Bush administration got cold feet and allowed the Iraqi Air Force to fly again and use its helicopters and drop barrel bombs on the Kurds and the Shiites that he was able to consolidate, that Saddam was able to consolidate his position again. Bush, I think, probably makes a mistake in leaving that part of the history out. Saddam could have been overthrown in 91 by his own people, in which case there would not have been an American occupation. And if there had been a civil war in Iraq as a result, it would have been a lot less violent and destructive than the one that came in the wake of the American invasion.
It probably would not have had the kind of religious overtones that it has today.
Well, at that time, the number of Islamic groups in Iraq were infinitesimal. Like the ones that existed were the Shiite ones, like Ad-Dawah, who now govern Iraq. The Sunnis there were no Sunni fundamentalist parties in Iraq. There were secular parties like the Communist Party and a branch of the Ba'ath Party that was against Saddam and other groups. But the Sunnis didn't have a fundamentalist streak in Iraq at that time.
Let's get to your article. In September, you took a trip through Syria, which you described meeting people in New York Review of Books of November 7th. Interesting article because it gives a very different impression about the situation in Syria than what you see ordinarily in the mainstream press. That depends where you are in Syria, you live very differently. Perhaps you could kind of summarize what you saw and felt in Syria and what we should take away from that.
Well, there are large areas of Syria under the control of the regime where life is practically normal. Children go to school, people go to work. If you go from Damascus, which is fairly quiet, there's fighting in the suburbs and occasional mortars from rebels in the suburbs into the city, and a lot of heavy bombardment of the suburbs by the Syrian Air Force and Syrian artillery. But once you're in the center of Damascus, it's quiet and life is normal, although there are tensions because of the war, and the regime, of course, still arrests people that it suspects are dissidents. But you can drive now, which you couldn't a year ago, you can drive north up to Homs, which was the birthplace of the revolution, the cradle of the revolution, as it was called, where the most violent clashes took place in 2011, 2012. That's back in regime hands. The rebels surrendered it over to the regime earlier this year. You can now, and this has happened since I left, and I left in September. Since I left, you can now go straight up that road all the way to Aleppo, and journalists have been there this week, and most of Aleppo is back in regime hands, although certain parts are still in the hands of the rebels. And these are various groups of rebels, both the Islamists and the what's left of the Free Syrian Army. But then you can go further west along to the Mediterranean Sea, where the two largest cities on the coast, Tartus and Latakia, are completely quiet. People go to the beach. The restaurants are open late. businesses are functioning, the schools are functioning. In fact, 90% of the schools in Syria have reopened on time in September. Life, you wouldn't, and there are many days there, you would not know there was a war going on. It's only when you go inland to the front lines that you're aware of it. But then, of course, in eastern Syria, the Islamic State has taken that whole area, and the Kurds control an area as well.
Now, when the U.S. initiated its bombing campaign against Daesh, there are many people who thought here again that this was merely going to be used as a means of bombing, eventually attacking the Assad regime itself. But from what you write and from what it seems, the Assad regime has in fact welcomed the U.S. air attacks, and there has been evidently some communication between the U.S. and Syria over this.
There's been, for the past 6 months, there's been communication between various Western powers who had originally wanted to depose the regime and the regime itself, mainly at the intelligence level, so that European intelligence people have been coming to Damascus and meeting with Syrian intelligence people to discuss how best to deal with the Islamic State, because now most of the Western countries see the Islamic State as a greater threat than they see the Assad regime. The Assad regime, they may not have liked it because of its relationship with Iran and its support for Hezbollah and Lebanon, but the Assad regime never threatened a Western country. Now the Islamic State daily makes threats against Western countries, and it's destabilized not only Syria, but Iraq and, to a lesser extent, Lebanon.
Now I saw in the reports in the New York Times and elsewhere that an Egyptian jihadist group, Ansar Beit al-Maqdis, which is far more active than the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which has been attacking, killing Egyptian soldiers, has now sworn its loyalty to Daesh, to the Islamic State. And this seems an opportunistic move, but on its part, but this seems to likely to spread this war over the entire region. Is that your the way you're looking at it?
I wouldn't say that it spread over the entire region. The Egyptian case is very specifically Egyptian. Beit al-Maqdis people, they see in the Islamic State winners, people with money and arms who can help them, and so they've turned to them for that sort of help. It will be problematic getting men and weapons across the Syrian desert, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and so forth to get into Sinai and Egypt. But if the Egyptian regime should certainly be worried about this. But since the Egyptian regime locked up the elected government of Muslim Brothers and then repressed their membership, the Islamists, they're not exactly holding out a hand to the Islamists to offer them anything other than armed opposition.
In Syria, a lot of attention was paid to the entrance into the war of Hezbollah, where obviously, from Hezbollah's standpoint, the collapse of the Damascus regime, Assad regime, would have cut off an important lifeline. How active is Hezbollah fighting in Syria at the moment, and do they fight together with the Syrian government forces, or they operate on their own?
Hezbollah fought in Syria in conjunction with the Syrian army, and they fought particularly in areas close to the Lebanese border where they felt that their own interests were at stake. So they were absolutely decisive in the Battle of Qusair, which is near the Lebanese border. And when Qusair and the area around Qusair was taken, it cut off Sunni supply lines from Lebanon to the opposition. Since then, Hezbollah's role has diminished somewhat because the areas of fighting are much further from Lebanon and therefore of less interest to Hezbollah's leadership. And it's interesting that Hezbollah, because of its dependence on the regime in Damascus, is against Islamic fundamentalists for a secular regime when it is itself Islamic fundamentalist, albeit Shiite.
Well, it certainly is not, at least what I was able, when I was in Lebanon, to the degree Al-Qaeda or certainly even Hamas or what I know about Iran.
Well, Hezbollah, after the kidnapping era ended in 1990, when it stopped, when it let go its Western hostages and decided to become a legitimate political party and run for elections, changed its tack entirely. And it said that it was the Shiites in Lebanon were one of many communities, and that they had to survive with the others and therefore could not impose an Islamic Republic like in Iran. So they would simply be a party, they would run for office, they've run in coalition with Christian parties, and they've done their best to cooperate with other Lebanese groups. But they've also taken advantage of the fact that they're the only militia left with arms in Lebanon. All the others gave their arms up, and have occasionally used those arms to try and force their political will on other Lebanese who did not want them to.
My take when the Syrian protest began, that seemed like an opportunity for the Sunnis in Lebanon, as well as in Saudi Arabia, but the Sunnis in Lebanon to become involved in what was to become a Sunni-Shia struggle. I remember a friend of mine, a Maronite in Beirut, telling me at the price of Kalashnikovs, AK-47s, immediately rose like $2,000 a piece when the Syrian protest began. How much, as far as you know, involvement did Lebanese Sunnis have in the uprising in Syria?
The Sunnis from Lebanon have had very little involvement in the war in Syria. Some have gone over as individuals to join one group or another, but their numbers are too few to be decisive. And most of the Sunnis in Lebanon, as far as one can tell, want to stay out of the Syria war and want Lebanon to stay out of the Syria war. And by Lebanon staying out, I mean they themselves, but also Hezbollah staying out. The Prime Minister of Lebanon, Tamam Salam, who is himself Sunni, has done everything he can to minimize the overflow of the Syrian war into Lebanon and also to keep Lebanon out of engagement with Syria. But Lebanon has now almost 2 million Syrian refugees in the country, and it's had armed clashes with some of the ones who are fundamentalists in a village called Arsal, where they kidnapped a large group of Lebanese soldiers and beheaded some of them. And so the tensions are high, but so far, the great fear of the Syrian war putting so much pressure on Lebanon that Lebanon itself will burst into civil war, it has not happened. But that is always in the background. It's always a fear for the Lebanese.
Well, it seems that what is from your article, what Daesh is doing has certainly turned a number of people off. Your article begins with the stories of the beheadings of Syrian soldiers by Daesh. And we heard about the beheadings of the two American journalists, but this seems to be a common practice. As far as you know, is it still continuing?
The Islamists of the Islamic State and some of the other groups put those videos on their social media fairly frequently. I mean, in Raqqa, the standard punishment for serious crimes is decapitation, and that hasn't changed. And they still, the ones who are holding those Lebanese soldiers, for example, are still threatening to behead more of them unless some of their prisoners in Lebanese prisons are released.
I wanted to get to a project that you have undertaken to have a monument erected to Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Chelsea Manning as heroes of our time, which I think is a very impressive and important project. I want to get to that in a moment, but I do want to ask you where you think this is going now. Is the Sykes-Picot borders created in World War I, which created the modern state of Iraq that divided Syria from Lebanon? Are these borders essentially being redrawn, non-existent?
Well, the only one that's non-existent at the moment is the border in the desert between Syria and Iraq, which wasn't much of a border anyway. I mean, it's been penetrated by tribes and smugglers since the line was drawn. If the Islamic State goes away, then the border will be back to what it was. I don't really see any other lines being redrawn. No one's saying that the borders with Turkey or with Israel or with between Jordan and Syria are meant to change. No, I mean it doesn't seem to be happening.
What about the situation with the Kurds, however? They seem to be today in a better position to actually have an enlarged Kurdish state than ever before.
Well, you seem to have two Kurdish states. You have the Kurdish regional government in Iraq, and now there's a separate Kurdish regional, I would call it administration, in eastern Syria along the border, which has been fighting against the Islamic State probably more ferociously than anyone else because they are extremely seasoned fighters with a lot of experience fighting the Turkish army in Turkey. And these Syrian Kurds have not shown so far that they want to unite with the Kurdish regional government in Iraq, but just to keep their own autonomy within Syria for the time being. So again, I don't see the border disappearing, just that these two Arab states of Iraq and Syria will have to allow regional governments for the Kurds, and maybe someday independence, but certainly that's a long way down the line.
And for the Kurds in Turkey?
The Kurds in Turkey are negotiating with President Erdogan and have been for the last couple of years for more rights to use their language and to teach their language in schools and to broadcast in their language and to have local autonomy, regional administration, and so forth. Erdogan has given a little bit, but not enough to satisfy them. And now at the moment, because Erdogan was so reluctant to allow Kurdish fighters from Iraq to go through Turkey to come and defend the village of Kobani in Syria against the Islamic State, their trust in Erdogan has diminished significantly.
And how is Erdogan viewed in Syria? Not by the government.
It depends on who
but
you talk to. I think the Islamists, for the most part, like him because he's facilitated their movement back and forth across the border. Until very recently, at arms, and they've been on the record quoted saying that the relationship with the Turkish government is very good. If you talk to the regime people, of course, they hate Turkey because they see Turkey as being behind the external attempt to change the regime in Syria.
Well, it's a complicated situation, which is going to Turkey being a NATO member, which makes it even more complicated. I want to give some time for you to talk about your Kickstarter project on the statue to Snowden, Assange, and Manning. Perhaps you could talk about that briefly.
Well, Manning, Assange, and Snowden are three people who took a great risk to tell us what our governments are doing to us, how our phone calls are all being monitored, how our emails are all recorded and read, how we've lost our Fourth Amendment protection against government surveillance without any probable cause, and also particularly with the WikiLeaks documents that Manning provided to Assange, which Assange published in the New York Times and The Guardian and elsewhere. We know many of the activities, torture, murder, assassination programs, and so on, which we would not have known about otherwise. Now, those three people have lost their freedom. Manning has been sentenced to 35 years in federal prison. Julian Assange is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, and no charges have ever been brought against him. He's accused of sexual misbehavior in Sweden, but no charges have been lodged against him. They say he's simply wanted for questioning, and the Swedish prosecutors refused to come to Britain to question him, whereas they have in other cases come to Britain and other European countries to question witnesses. And he's legitimately afraid that if he is taken to Sweden, he could be rendered to the United States, as other people from Sweden have been rendered to the United States. And Snowden himself has basically lost his freedom because he's stuck in a very unfree country, Russia, and in Moscow, and cannot travel anywhere in the world. And he's given up. He's a young man who's given up his freedom for us. So we've made a statue. The Italian sculptor Davide Dormino has made a beautiful statue of the three of them standing on three chairs, making a stand for us, with a fourth empty chair that represents any one of us who wants to stand next to them.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's a beautiful concept. How do people contact you or about that or get more information about what you're doing and what you're writing?
Well, you can go to the Kickstarter site, Anything to Say, and it's very easy to make a small donation. You can give as little as £5. We need to raise £100,000 to pay the foundry for the bronzing of the statue. Davide Dorino, the consultant, has donated his time, and it's been almost a year-long project, so it's quite a commitment from him. But it's the foundry that needs to be paid, and now we're hoping that once that's done and that $100,000 is raised, and we only have 60 days in which to raise it, as you know, with Kickstarter, you have a set time limit. And if you don't raise it within that time, then the money all goes back to the donors, and you have to start over again. We're hoping then to place it in a public square in Paris, and if that goes well, and in the future we can raise more money, we will cast another one and put it in London and or Washington or Madrid or Rome, wherever we can, wherever people want it.
Where can people view the statue?
At the moment, it's on its way. The cast is on its way to the foundry, so you can't view it.
No, I mean online. I did see a picture of it online, but I don't remember what the link was.
We're having an event in London on the 26th of November at the Frontline Club in London, and also at the same time at Shakespeare and Company Bookshop in Paris. If you go to the website, which is frontline.com, or the Frontline Club in London, and go to events, you'll find that event, and there are pictures of the statue. There are also pictures and video of the statue on the Kickstarter site.
No, it's very impressive, and I could see it or copies of it traveling around the world to represent heroes of our time. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's a terrific idea. What should we be looking for, do you think, given the now more hawkish turn of the U.S. Congress, with this new election swing to the right, further to the right of the United States, what impact do you think this is going to have on the war in Syria?
Well, Obama's already committed $5 billion to it, and he's sent, I forget the number, I think 1,500 now to Iraq. The Republicans and Obama will have to decide how they want to act and who against whom they want to act. If they're going back to the original plan, which was to overthrow the regime in Syria, then they'll have to become effectively allies of the Islamic State. And if they want to fight the Islamic State, they will effectively become allies of the Syrian regime. So they'll have to, if they want to go to war, they're going to have to go to war for one side or the other. The third force option, the ostensible a moderate Syrian opposition, armed opposition, basically doesn't exist anymore. So they tried that for years in Vietnam to find a third force between the Viet Cong and the Saigon government, and it never materialized because in a time of such violence, people are polarized. And they're going to be on one side or the other. What they ought to have done was not to take the military approach, but the diplomatic approach, and work with the Russians and the Iranians and the Saudis and the Turks to have compelled the Syrians to sign an agreement which would have led to a transitional government. And they came close to that in Geneva, but they didn't. The United States and the Russia could not agree, and that was a tragedy for Syria. And it was after that that the Islamic State really grew.
So the prospects for the future, and us speaking again in maybe a year or so about the same subject, are great, are better than...
I would assume that there'll be more chaos in a year than there is even now.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Charles Glass, for being our guest today. His article in the New York Review of Books, November 6th issue, In the Syria We Don't Know. I do recommend that. Again, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes the World and shedding some light on the subject.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.